children to be successful. And that's what we want, isn't it? So there are five areas that we've come up with of success and parental involvement. These are areas of success for our children which parents make a significant difference in. The fact that children can succeed in these areas with negligent parents, this doesn't excuse the behavior of the parents, does it? That just means 1 Corinthians 10:13, God had mercy on the children. The parent, however, will still have wood, hay, and stubble in heaven. That's no testimony. That's no testimony at all. I received Christ my junior year of high school. I grew up in a secular, non-Christian home. Both my parents were alcoholics. They were very successful professionals. My dad was a senior executive in a pharmaceutical company. My mother was a nurse and successful real estate agent. And then there was great affluence and monetary and cultural success in our home. But that's all. But our home was empty. It was like the whitewashed tomb that Jesus spoke of in terms of the Pharisees. Beautiful on the outside, but inside full of death and rot and bones. And that was our home. And God looked down on that home and had mercy. And there were three children who were growing up in that home, abused, neglected, ignored, in degradation and sin. And all three were saved and entered full-time Christian service. Okay? We all entered full-time Christian service. Now, having said that, my mother later received Christ. In fact, when she died, she was senior citizen of the year in her church. She was active in the evangelism and outreach program. She was department head of the Sunday school department. She had a parking spot at the church with her name on it. In every way, she turned her life around because of 2 Corinthians 5:17. But when I would preach, and she would come to hear me preach, and then people would come up to her afterwards and say, "Oh, Mrs. Mahan, what a blessing. Here, your son is a preacher. Your other son is a preacher. Your daughter works for a missionary association. Tell us, what was the secret of raising your children?" She couldn't even say she prayed for us. All she could say is, "Well, you just have to love them and, you know, learn from your pastor." That's all she could say. So how children turn out as adults is not a reflection of their parenting. It's a reflection of decisions they make before God, isn't it? So if we have negligent parents who, in the name of the Lord or any other name, neglect their children, and their children, quote, turn out all right, that's a reflection on God, not of them. They still have wood, hay, and stubble in heaven waiting, don't they? So what we are concerned about here is obeying God, bringing glory to His name, because we love Him as parents, okay? That's where we're going. I can also say that one of the benefits you have of receiving this seminar from Eleanor and I, who did not come from Christian parents, is that we do two things. One, we take parenting very seriously, but we also recognize it's not an innate skill. It's something that is learned, that you study, and that you develop yourself. And sometimes when children who grow up in Christian families, they just take it for granted. And they don't really know what they're doing. They just do it kind of as a reflex because it was done for them. And so I always tell people, if you want to learn how to witness, don't go to someone with the gift of evangelism. Because he'll say, "Oh, it's easy. You just kind of talk to people and then they come to Christ and, you know, just get out there. It's easy." But I don't have the gift of evangelism. I know it's not easy. You know, and there needs to be some systems and some trainings and some help for us who do not have the gift of evangelism. If you want to learn how to lead music and help a group sing like our brother here did. You don't want to learn from somebody who's a gifted musician. Why? Oh, it's easy. You just get up there, you know, the rhythm comes to you. You just sing, it all just happens. Just, you know, just let the spirit flow. It's easy. But it's not easy. I'm not gifted in music. I'm not gifted in rhythm. It takes training to be able to do it if you're not gifted, doesn't it? And that's what Eleanor and I bring to you. We're not going to stand up here and say, oh, parenting's just easy. You just love them and bring them in and then you get on with life. No, we know that's not true. It's hard work. And so this is what we bring to you. The first thing, area of success when we talk about drawing near to our children by helping our children to be a success, the first area of parental involvement is work. Proverbs 22:29 states, do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. Teaching your children to be hard workers is a very important skill. I had a friend whose father taught him to work very hard. And this man was indeed a very hard worker. He had risen to be the principal of a school. In summer, when school was out, he had a roofing business. In addition to that, he trained dogs professionally. In addition to that, he could train horses professionally. He had bought some land. He had all sorts of endeavors going on. He was a very hard and successful worker. And he had come from a kind of a poor rural environment and now was living very successfully. Educated, articulate, had risen to a position of influence in his culture. So I would say his father gave him a gift, didn't he? But when I would talk to this man, I'll call him Larry. I would talk to him. Larry would say, well, you know, when I was little as I can remember, my father, you know, he didn't have much of an education and he had to work hard and he was a roofer and he would take me out there and I can remember before I could nail the things on the roof, I would just carry them and put them at the base of the ladder and bring them in water. And then when I got old enough, I would have to take them up on the ladder. And as soon as I could use a hammer, he taught me how to use the hammer. And I always spent my summers and my Saturdays at working and saving up a little money. And he never had enough money to give me anything. I had to work for some of the other contractors to get my bicycle, to get my school supplies. And I had to work all my life very hard. And I thought, wow, what a gift to learn to work hard. And so he said, so I decided I wasn't going to push that on my son. And he didn't. My son was a friend of his, and his son was lazy, never reaching his potential. Completely unmotivated. And I used to talk to Larry, and I used to say, you know, your father gave you a great gift. You shouldn't be resentful for that. You should pass that on to your children. And unfortunately, many of us in life who grew up in situations where we learned to work very hard, we think we're blessing our children by them not having to work hard. And yet, it is that very gift that our parents gave us in hard work that brought us to this place where we are, isn't it? It's like my in-laws used to say to us, you know, your children, they're so well-behaved, they're so well-mannered, they're so articulate, we just love having them around us. Of all the children in the extended family, yours are the one that's so easy to go to the market with or to have in the home. And they're just such a delight. If only you didn't spank them, your home would be perfect. Now, what's the problem with that logic? That's why they were that way, isn't it? You know, I had a great childhood. My parents just made me work too hard. You know, I would have a perfect childhood if I just hadn't had to work too hard. No, that's why you are where you are right now. Because you had to work hard. And that's a gift that you give your children, to work hard. Now, the first question, as I was reflecting on, Why do parents have a problem with this? Why? What is the problem here? Work. Well, one is a false doctrine, a misunderstanding of work. Some people think work is a result of the fall of man. The reason we have to work is a result of the fall. If it wasn't for the sin of Adam, and by the way, it was not Eve, it was Adam. God holds Adam responsible for the fall. Don't say if only women hadn't got into trouble with Satan, there'd be no work in the world, because that's not true. God specifically holds Adam responsible. Eve was deceived, Adam rebelled. Okay? We can nail that down later if you have questions. If it wasn't for Adam, you would say, we wouldn't have to work. But that's not true. Genesis 2:15 says, and then the Lord God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it, to keep it. Adam was working hard. In Ephesians 2:10, as Christians we are told, we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works. That's part of our blessing in life, is to be able to work. Now, the sin of Adam resulted not in work, but in unfruitful work. That he would labor by toil and by sweat, and instead of roses and tomatoes and maize, up would come thorns and thistles from the ground by the sweat of his brow. And then, broken and beaten, he would one day die. That's the curse. Unfruitful labor. Not work. Work is a blessing from God. So one of the reasons is that false doctrine, a bad view of work. Now another reason is that teaching children to work must be taught, and that takes time. And many times parents are too busy with their own lives, in their own recreation, their own work, and their own pursuit to have time for their children. They just don't have time for their child. And so their child is neglected in this area. There is the protective parent. I don't want my child to have to go through what I went through. We've already talked about that, haven't we? I don't want my child to go without things in life I had to go without. And yet, going without those very things and having to work hard made you what you are today, didn't it? Our children never received what our money could buy them. Simply because they wanted a particular toy or a particular item. That never meant we bought that for them. No. We always made it clear that our children, when they wanted something, the phrase, why can't I have it? We can afford to buy it. That never meant anything to us. Eleanor and I never lived in as nice a house as we could afford. We could always have afforded better. We never lived and drove as nice a car as we could afford. We could always have had better. And we never gave our children as nice clothes and toys as we could afford. We could always have better. We lived in the house that we felt, as stewards of God's resources, He wanted us to live in. We drove the type of car as a steward of God's resources that we needed. Not that we could have. We needed. And we gave our children clothes and toys as stewards of those children. What would be best for them? And what is new and modern and cutting edge very rarely is the best thing for our children to have. Very rarely is it the best thing. So, I don't want my children to go without. I had to go without. Well, by going without, it made you what you are today, didn't it? You are a product of that. Sometimes, it's the busy parent. It's just easier to do it yourself, isn't it? Isn't that true? Eleanor always points out to the mothers, if you're teaching your children to make their own bed, a child doesn't make a bed at 5 years old the way a woman of 35 can make a bed. Isn't that true? But the goal is for the child to learn to make the bed. The child to learn how to work, which brings us to the perfectionist parent. If I want it done right, I'll have to do it myself. And I can remember when I had a job to do around the house, like painting or working in the yard or working on the car. If I had my son working with me, would it look as good as if I had done it by myself? No, it wouldn't. He was in the learning curve, wasn't he? Plus, there are the sins of youth. There's distraction. There's uncoordination. There are many things that go in when you have a younger person helping you do a job. But the objective wasn't just the perfect job, was it? It was to draw near to my child by teaching my child to work. There is the affluent parent. We pay people to do that. We pay people to do that. I don't do that type of work. My children don't do that type of work. Well, we have a lady who comes in once a week to help Eleanor with the housework. And Eleanor would tell her, don't clean this bathroom. That's the children's job. Don't clean the children's room. That's their job. There would be areas of the house that were off limits to her. Otherwise, how are our children going to grow? Don't do the children's laundry. That's their work. She was there as my blessing to Eleanor. Because Proverbs 31, the Bible says that the husband of a godly wife gives portions to her maidens. In other words, he supplies her with some help so that she can live a broader life. But in doing that, we didn't spoil our children. They had to grow up learning the value of work. In 1 Corinthians 1, what kind of people does God choose to be Christian? Is it the elite? No. If you're a Christian, you are despised, you are despicable, you are depraved, you are a nobody. And so we didn't raise our children thinking they were better than other people. I haven't been so embarrassed in the homes of Christians who have full-time house help in their homes. I've seen the children treat that house help worse than I can imagine any colonial ruler ever treated a Kenyan. Ordering them around, pointing at them, speaking curtly to them. That's wrong. That's sin. God said to Israel, remember that you were slaves in Egypt. And so we don't raise our children thinking they are little dukes and lords, do we? They can clean toilets and polish shoes and take out trash and do laundry and make beds. That's how they learn to work hard, isn't it? My son played on a baseball team with an oil executive, the child of an oil executive from South Africa. And they had immigrated from South Africa to Houston to work in the oil industry there. And we were watching the game, and I was talking with the man and his wife, and she said, actually, this has been good for my children. They were growing up with people opening the doors for them when they come home from school, getting them tea, cleaning their rooms, fetching them themselves. That's not the real world. She said, the best thing that happened to my children was to come to America where you don't have these things. Now they're learning to work hard. Well, I thought that was kind of insightful, wasn't it? We have to make sure our children learn how to work hard. Just because you can afford something doesn't mean it's good for your children, does it? We need to reflect on that. The affluent parent. We pay people to do that. The lazy parent. Life is more than work. Well, unfortunately, it's not. Life is very hard work. The result of this has been a generation of children who don't know how to work hard. And an embarrassed generation of parents because their parents lived at this level, and then their grandparents lived at this level, and their parents worked very hard and were at this level. And now you have worked very hard, and now you are at this level in terms of your education and your economics. Then we are faced for the first time with a generation of children who are not only living at the educational and economic level of their parents, but very often stepping down. Now, why is that? I mean, you can't go up and up forever, right? Can't be the king of the world. But why would you all of a sudden have a generation of children who aren't getting into good schools, who aren't able to get jobs, who are taking lesser employment and living at a lower standard? It's because they were never taught to work hard. They were never taught to work hard. It's the man skilled in his work that stands before kings, isn't it? The hard worker. So what is a successful worker? When we sought to teach our children to be successful in this area, well, I found five biblical virtues that I felt were important for my children in this area, just in studying the Bible. The first is, a successful worker must be teachable. Proverbs 1:5 says, a wise man will hear and increase in learning. A man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. Conversely, Proverbs 13:18 says, poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline, but he who regards reproof will be honored. I know my son has told me a number of times, both when he was in the university, when he was in the military, and now that he is in the oil industry, and he was very successful in all three of those fields, he said one of the things he is most thankful for in the way he was raised is that he could stand there and listen to people correct him and learn from them, even if they weren't doing it in the right way. And he says, a lot of my peers are not getting ahead because they not only don't want to be lectured to, but if they are taught something, it has to be done in a very respectful, humble, just the right way, or they aren't willing to learn. And so they're always getting into trouble. Teach your children to be teachable, to receive instruction. Remember, let's go all the way back to week 3. I will obey mommy quickly the first time. Now, how can they do that? Well, let's go back to week 2. Look me in the eye. Listen to me. Repeat what I said. Remember that? At 9 months, at 11 months, instruct at their level, discipline, instruct, restore. That our children grew up in which learning, being teachable, learning from their mistakes, that was a lifestyle. That's just something you do. And yet there are so many people, I run into them at church, in the community, they just can't learn. You can just see the tension. Anytime you try to teach them something, you can just see the tension coming, you know. A successful worker is a trustworthy worker. Proverbs 25:19 says, like a bad tooth and an unsteady foot is confidence in a faithless man in a time of trouble. Remember when way back, week 4, we were talking about levels of discipline and the training span and the child learning to start a job and bring it to completion, pick up all of the blocks and put them in the box, right? We said that that was laying the foundation of being able to be given a responsibility and to complete it unsupervised, didn't we? That's called a faithful man. And I know as pastor of the church, and when I was in the adult education ministry of the church, we would be putting on a conference or an event, or when I was in the college ministry, we would be putting on some sort of event. And when I gave a responsibility to someone and they really wanted to do that, I knew I was going to have to finish it for them. Why? because many a man proclaims his own steadfast love, but who can find a faithful man? I knew they just would not be able to bring it completion. Something would happen. It would get difficult. There would be distraction. They wouldn't feel well. Something would happen at work. There's always something that will keep them from faithfully fulfilling their responsibilities. My older brother taught me this verse my freshman year. That a righteous man, what? Swears to his own hurt and doesn't change. Now you might not agree to it again, but for a Christian gentleman, his word is his bond. Yes, Pastor, I'll be there. The doors will be open 30 minutes ahead of time. Where will he be? He'll be there. And what will the doors be? Open. When? 30 minutes beforehand. Because he's a faithful man. And that pastor, when he gets there, and not only are the doors open, but he's a Philemon 121 man. I know that you will do what is required of you and even more. The doors are open. The lights are on. He has been given a task and he has been able to extrapolate out and think through of all the corollary responsibilities that go with that task and has fulfilled that too. How would you like that man on the committee? How about a committee head? Maybe a deacon or an elder, right? Because he's a faithful man that doesn't just do what's required of him, but he can think through of all the other things, and you never hear the faithful man say, well, that wasn't my job. Could you make sure the doors were unlocked? So he comes in, he unlocks the doors, he noticed that the breaker switch around the side needs to be flipped. He also noticed that the people who were there beforehand had the chairs in a circle, and he knows they need to be up like this. And he also noticed that nobody bothered to erase the boards, and the teacher's going to... So he comes in and he fixes all that up, doesn't he? That's a wonderful gift to give your children. And that's why as a young second lieutenant, my son was temporarily promoted to executive officer to a full colonel, because he knew if he put him in charge of the banquet by which the flag was being changed at the base, everything would get done. Now that was a great gift I gave my son, wasn't it? That's why when the dormitory was going to have to select an individual to go represent them at the president's banquet, to sit at the table of the president's university, one of my children was chosen for that because they were responsible. They would be faithful. They would get everything done. That's a great gift I gave my children, wasn't it? It's not enough that your children just do the work. Make them a faithful worker. Make them a hard worker. What does Proverbs 6:6-8 say? Go to the ant, your sluggard, and observe her ways and be wise. Ants are hard workers, aren't they? 2 Chronicles 31:20-21. Thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judah. He did what was good, right, and true before the Lord his God. And every work which he began, anything Hezekiah began, in the service of the house of God, in the law, in the commandment, in seeking his God, he did it with all of his heart and was prosperous. Hezekiah was a hard working king. Ah! 2 Chronicles 31:20-21. Hezekiah. Proverbs 6:6-8. The ant and the sluggard. That's a blessing from God that we give our children to be a hard worker. And you know what goes hand in hand with a hard worker? To be an uncomplaining worker. To work without complaining. Ecclesiastes 5:18, the uncomplaining worker. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and to enjoy oneself in what? In all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. It's a gift of God to be able to work. It's his reward. There are many people without jobs who would like jobs, aren't there? Educated men. There are many people with physical restrictions on them. Their eyes, their ears, their hands, their feet, their hips, their back, they can't work, can they? It is a gift of God to be a worker. And we would teach our children to work without complaining. A child who is doing something around the house and is complaining can plan on settling in for the day and learn to work without complaining. Now, we had very little patience for complaining about work around the house. Oh, you don't like to do your own laundry? Well, good. Mommy has a lot of laundry. Look, you're going to learn today what a blessing it is that God has given you clothes and soap and a house and a place where you can do laundry, that you're not down at the river someplace, or you're not just wearing dirty clothes and begging, and then you have to hide somewhere and take off your clothes and wash them and put them back on, that you have clothes to launder. So this is just going to be a laundry day. And you'll be doing laundry all day, and we'll be talking about what a blessing it is to have it. Isn't that how you do it? That's how you learn, isn't it? I don't have to like all the difficult things God has given me to do, but I don't have the right to be whining and complaining and making other people miserable. There are some people in church, I never use this phrase, how are you today? I never say that. I only say, it's good to see you. God bless you, it's good to see you. If I ask them how they are, they will begin whining and complaining. So that's a gift we give our children. A gift we give our children is to be a skillful worker. Proverbs 22:29, do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. And to teach our children, when they do something, to do it in a skillful way. They would bring us their homework, and we would look at the pages and make sure not only the problem was done correctly, but it was done legibly. That the handwriting was neat. Not only that they had the right answer, but they did all of the correct mathematical equations to get that answer. No shortcuts. Because later in the mathematical discipline, you won't be able to do the shortcuts, will you? And unless you know the correct equation and the correct order of the equation, you won't be able to just tick it off in your head, will you? So we made sure they were skilled in what they did. Now, children may not use this gift, but at least they will have it, won't they? When I was in school, the Vietnam War was going on, and there was compulsory military service for everybody, unless you were enrolled in university. Then you could delay it. And so you had two types of university students. One had been through the military already, and then one was waiting to see if they would have to go in the military after they graduated. So, you know, in military, you know how men are trained, you know, in basic training, and, you know, they have to keep their uniforms perfect, don't they, and their shoes shined, and everything has to be polished and brass, and, you know, the first sergeant, the drill sergeant goes in, and he opens up the drawer, and the socks have to be perfect, and there can't, you know, he takes a white glove, and everything has to be perfect, doesn't it? That's basic training. So these men knew that, but when they came to college, how did they live? Just like all the other college students, didn't they? Did they keep that up? No, they just looked like bums. Just like all the other college students live, don't they? Bed unmade, wrinkled t-shirts, you know. But it came time to apply for jobs on graduation. Who knew how to present themselves before authority, right? The regular college students, I mean, they would try to put on a shirt and tie, and you know, they would try to polish their shoes, but they would get some of the polish on the bottom of their shoe, so it makes scuffs on the floor, and some on their sock, and they would forget to polish the back of the shoe, so it looks kind of funny, and you know, they tried to iron their shirt, but they didn't know how to iron a shirt, and their roommate had to teach them how to tie the tie, and they showed up, and their coat was wrinkled, and they didn't know how to relate to authority. They were intimidated, and you know, how do I hold myself? What do I say? But not so with the military men, did they? You see, they had these skills. They weren't using them, but they had them, didn't they? And that's how it is with our children. The reason we teach them to be hard workers is not because it guarantees us that they will always use it, but they will have the gift, won't they? They will have the gift. It is a gift we are giving them. We want them to be successful because we love them. We know what it takes to be successful, so we give them that gift because we love them. Remember the illustration I used? I had a friend in the college ministry who had a very laissez-faire, very relaxed view of child raising. And he said to me one day, "You know, John, when your children are teenagers, they're going to rebel against all of this structure." He said it very confidently. Well, I told him, and by the way, they didn't. They didn't rebel against it. They were very thankful for it when they were teenagers. But I said to him, I'll call him Larry again. I said, "Well, Larry, I don't know if they will or not. I hope they don't. I mean, I'm not being cruel to them. There's no reason for them to be bitter towards me. So I hope they don't. But I can tell you something about your children. When your children are teenagers, they are going to be unruly and rebellious simply because they are going to continue down the path they are on. There's no reason for them to be any different. They won't have an alternative. Unless God in His mercy brings about difficult situations through the state and through the church and through the educational systems to undo and redirect them, I know how your children will turn out." And so then there was an awkward pause, because people who criticize you only feel they have the right to criticize you. They never feel you have the right to respond. Isn't that true? So there was that awkward pause as he reflected on the reality and the truth of what I said. And it turned out to be true, too. It turned out to be true. Train up a child in the way he should not go, and in the end, that's where he'll end up, isn't it? Isn't that true? Okay. So that's what it is. How do we do this? Well, if you teach your children to work, you'll put them on the road to success. If you teach them to do it. And what I always say to parents, that the with Him principle taught by Jesus, and He appointed 12 that they might be with Him, and He might send them out to preach. Jesus wanted the disciples to be with Him, observing Him in the ministry, didn't He? The with Him principle changes the process from slave labor to co-labor. And that's very important in the relationship, isn't it? You don't just walk around with the yard with a yardstick pointing at things, telling your children what they need to do, then you go get your beer and turn on the football game and sit on the couch, right? Fall asleep while your children do all the work. No, but our children grew up working with us. The daughters grew up working with Eleanor in the kitchen, doing housework with Eleanor. Sam grew up doing yard work with me. I mowed my own yard. I pulled my own weeds. I washed my own car, and Sam grew up doing those things with me. He learned how to mow the lawn, to pull weeds, to lay bricks on a patio, to put together an outdoor grill, to lay foundation stones. He learned to do those things, to mow a lawn, to rake a lawn, to edge a lawn, how a lawn's supposed to look, to paint, do a little minor carpentry work. He learned to do those things by being with me, alongside me, as a gift I gave him. And that's the difference between slave labor and co-laboring, is the with-him principle. In the preschool years, up until the third grade, people's children should be responsible for their own room. You know, sometimes I'm teaching, and it's as if the angels, trumpets in heaven, begin to blow. You know, can't you almost hear them in the background, can't you? It's just like God's divine siren goes off to remind us, now this is important. You know, and then it goes away as quickly as it started. To me, it's amazing, you just never know, do you? Well, praise God. Okay. Keeping their own room, their play area, kitchen area, meals, toys and possessions. Children should start doing chores at a very early age. As they get older, yard work, house cleaning, washing the car, taking out trash, serving others. When you have house guests, your children should come in and greet them. And, may I get you some water? Would you like some tea? Can I fix you some tea? They should bring in a tray. They should know how to do this thing. And modeling is everything. Seeing you work hard is everything. Remember on the spiritual development of our children, we said more is caught than taught. They want to grow up and be just like Daddy. Well, is Daddy a hard worker? Well, how do they know if they never see him working hard? And we don't let our children fall in. So that's how we do it. We don't let our children fall into certain traps. There are some traps that you can fall in. The first is the money trap. How much will you pay me to do this? No. This is a responsibility around the house. I'm not going to pay you anything. The fairness trap. That's not my job. That's not a good character trait to grow up saying, that's not my job. The legal trap. Well, you didn't, clean up your room. Well, look at this mess up. Well, you didn't say that. No, remember? Stay in bed. Eat your food. Don't touch the pizza. We want to teach our children to think through on all the ramifications of a command and fulfill everything. The guilt trap. Nobody does this. I never get to have any fun. Oh, don't ever let your children make you feel guilty for helping them to be a success. What is the next area that we draw near to our children to help them to be a success? The next area is school. Your children are in school, learning in school, so that they can do well in college. I always reminded my son of that. All the other things that go on in school are nice. Why are you taking chemistry? So you can pass chemistry in college. That's why you're taking chemistry. Why are you taking mathematics? So that when you take the calculus course your freshman year that caused everybody to drop out, you will do well. Isn't that true? Why do you take 4 years of social studies? Why do you take this? So, at that freshman social studies class where they try to get people to drop out or change their majors, you do well. Isn't that right? Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord rather than men. And so when we help our children with their schoolwork, we're thinking of the future, aren't we? We're thinking of their future. So we always required our children to do more in school than what was required by the teachers. When our children would take tests, we had a notebook that they kept all of their tests in. And we would want to see the test. And then when they brought home a test, they would have to correct every wrong answer on the test, take it back to the teacher and get her to initial it. And the teacher said to me, well, I don't require students to do that. I said, well, that's all right. I require my children to do that. Being a good reader is essential. to spiritual growth and to advancement in life. Mathematics is essential to keep people from cheating you in life and for advancement in life. To be a good steward, isn't it? So that was never an option. Reading and mathematics was never an option for our children. And so when they came home, they were expected to do well in school. Now, why do some parents fail in this area? Main reason most parents fail in this area is because they are delegating raising their children to other people. They do not come home at night. They do not know how their children are doing at school. They do not have their children read to them. They do not have their children work on their mathematics tables with them when they were little. I can remember coming home from work and sitting down, and I would be exhausted. And I would sit down, and there would be one of my children there, and there would be a book, and I would say, "Oh, okay, start reading." And I would be so tired, and it would be such a basic story. And sometimes, I have to admit, sometimes I'd fall asleep and I'd catch myself, no, go on. But it's important for our children. They need to learn to read without using their fingers, don't they? And then they need to learn to read out loud, don't they? So that when they're called on in Sunday school to read out loud, they can read out loud. And then they need to learn to read silently, don't they? Silently without their fingers. And then we need to move them advanced literature, don't they? All of our children always tested out far above grade level in reading. I would never commit the reading skills of my children to a school or to a stranger. It's too critical an area. I let my children fail, learn by their failures in areas I don't have to suffer for. In areas when they fail, I pay the consequences, then failure is not an option. And school is one of those areas. So mathematics was another thing. After they got through reading, then we got out the flashcards. I would have it. On one side, I had written, you can buy these. Sometimes I had to write them. 1 + 1. And then there would be it. They would have to say it. And then they would turn it over and look at it. And we would go through. If they were in their additions, we would go through the additions. And I would pull out all the cards they missed. Then we would do that. Then later it was subtraction, then multiplication, then division. 5 times 5, 5 times 6, 5 times 7. Oh, you got that one wrong. We'll set it aside. And then we keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. And sometimes they would be almost in tears crying. But no, they have to know this, don't they, for their success. So if you are helping your child with mathematics and finally they are in tears, the best thing to do is just stop, isn't it? There's a polio epidemic, and you want to take your child down to get a polio shot. It's very painful, isn't it? Your child is going to cry, so the best thing to do is just not get the shot, right? Isn't that right? All your child likes to eat is cake and cookies, so the best thing to do is just feed your child cake and cookies. That will be best for them, right? No, we do these things for our children's success. How can a child feel good about himself or herself if they are not doing well academically in school? They can't, can they? Or they shouldn't. Some do, but they shouldn't. How do you do this? Well, what did we say? First, what is success in school? Success in school is working hard. And it's exhibiting virtues. Your teacher should say, yes, little Johnny, he's one of the most cooperative and teachable students I have. Then he's successful. He's trustworthy. He's hardworking. He never complains. He always has his work in on time. Hardworking. Trustworthy. We lay the virtues of future success in his career at work, at school. Now, how do you do it? If you're not there, if you're not involved, if you're delegating this, then it's not going to happen, is it? One of the things we taught our children is you have to do well and make good grades whether it's a good teacher or not. We never criticize the teacher to the children. Are you always going to have good employers? Are you always going to have good supervisors? Are you always going to have good deacons over you or good elders or good pastors? No. You learn to be successful in life because that's the right thing to do before God. Because it's a Christian virtue, don't you? Some things that Eleanor and I would do was all of the teachers knew us. We would introduce ourselves to the teacher. We would volunteer to serve. Homeroom, parent-teacher association. We would sign up for the classroom parties and to make sure that we were active. I would try to eat one meal a week at school with one of my children. In my job, we use my lunches for appointments, for business meetings, for business appointments. And so my secretary, when I was on staff at a church, she knew that Friday was blocked off. A deacon or somebody would call up and say, can Pastor John meet with us for lunch for this? And she'd look on the calendar and she'd say, I'm sorry, he's already got something scheduled for Friday. What about Thursday or Monday? It's already blocked off. You know what that was? That was lunch at school with one of my children. I like to be seen. I want people to grow up knowing that I'm an involved parent. They know who I am. The other kids know who I am. I have a presence there. I meet with and compliment the principal periodically through the year. Remember them on Christmas. Express my appreciation to all the teachers at Christmas time. I very often would give the principal my business card and say, you know, someday you're going to be in a meeting and you know it's an ambush and you need an ally there with you, and here's my business card. You can call on me because I know what a hard job you have. And I know there are many teachers, many parents who are not concerned that this school is well run. The only thing they are concerned with is their child gets to act any way they want to, and that's unfair to you. So here's my business card. About a year and a half later, one of our daughters was being bothered by some rough kids on the bus on the way to school. And so I went in to talk to the assistant principal in charge of the bus program, and I could tell he was busy and he really didn't have time to take care of this one situation. And he took down a couple names and dismissed us. And as we went out, I remember saying to Eleanor, well, nothing's going to happen. Well, the principal of the school said, oh, Reverend Mann, it's so good to see you. I hope everything's all right. It's the one I'd given my business card to. And I said, well, actually, I was a little disappointed. Our daughter's having a little trouble. Your daughter's having trouble? And called the name of the child. Oh, we know her. She's one of the good children. What's the trouble? I shared it with you. Well, was it resolved? I said, well, I'm just not sure. She said, just a minute. And she went in, talked to the gentleman a minute. He said, he would like to talk to you again. And we went in, and he said, I just want you to know that this situation will be taken care of immediately, that we will be on this 100%. And that was the last day the child that was bothering my daughter rode that bus. But if you are a teacher, if you are a parent who's always complaining, who's never there, the school is always wrong, the teacher is always wrong, the child is always right, there's always too much work. Right? When something like that happens, it's just another complaint, isn't it? And your child is learning to be a complainer, isn't it? The child is learning, I'm never wrong. It's the whole system's against me. That's why I'm not doing well. Don't we know people like that? That's not how we get involved with our children to help them be a success. We were always on the side of the authority. Because that's what our children have to learn to do. Work under the authority structure which the sovereignty of God has placed you. And I know ministers, I know college staff, I know people who can never get ahead in life because they just can't work under the authority God has placed over them.
Well,
get involved. School is your responsibility. It's nice that the nation of Kenya supplies you with schools, isn't it? But it's not guaranteed in the Bible that God holds you responsible for that. Okay? Then what's next? The next is something, a kind of a catch-all category that I call sports, music, or skills. These are the extra things that you give your children to help them excel in life. Just those little extra things. Proverbs 20:29 says, "The glory of young men is their strength." In Proverbs 31:17 it says, "She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong." There are some aspects of parental involvement in this that gives your child just that little edge. So anytime I hear of a parent who's having discipline problems with their teenager, one of the things a teenager needs, it's essential to get into trouble, is free time. And that one of the reasons our children had so little free time to get into trouble is that we required these things of them. These are extracurricular activities, aren't they? And we required these of them. All of our children had to learn some sports. They all had to learn music, and they all had to learn some skills beyond pure academic skills. Yeah? And these skills weren't just secular, but also spiritual. These things were not just played out in the secular realm, but also in the church realm. I know many young people, and one of the ways they get people, they try to get youth involved in church activities is maybe get together a football game or a basketball game or some sporting event to try to get children involved. Isn't that true? Well, if you haven't taken the time so that your child is skilled enough at basketball, and all the boys in the high school group before the Sunday school class or before the youth meeting are out in the church parking lot shooting basketball, and you haven't taken the time to help your child learn that, he's going to be on the outside, isn't he? If your child doesn't know how to dribble a football, how to pass it, how to kick the extra point, then he's going to be on the outside, isn't he? One of the great skills you can give children is music skills. Singing in the youth choir, playing in the youth band. That's how we get them involved in those things, isn't it? And perhaps they have some artistic skill. You know, all churches are excited for people who can help them make brochures and make posters and help decorate the church for different things. These are great skills you give them that open doors for them in the church, but also in the secular realm, isn't it? Why do parents fail in this area? Well, one is they're too busy. In a college ministry, I had the daughter of a Christian executive of a Christian organization, and this man had played sports. That's how he put himself through college, was playing sports. He was a very gifted athlete. But you know, in the college ministry, a lot of the social activities among college students is geared around impromptu sports, aren't they? Both in high school and college. And this girl was always on the sideline. She didn't know how to do anything. Now that's her dad's fault, isn't it? Just a few basic skills in this area, and she could have been participating. She could have been participating. Some fathers are just too busy to take an interest in their children. Now, all my children grew up playing catch with me, shooting basketball with me, doing activities in the park with me. It was great for our relationship, but also it was great in their success. And then when they began looking back on life and saying, why do things come easier for me than other people? Why is schoolwork easier for me? Why are there so many doors open for me because of sports and music and just a few basic skills that I have? You know, it's because of mom and dad. That's the difference. And that's when you're drawing near to your children by helping them be a success. When your children, during those elementary and junior high years, begin to equate the things you do for them and with them with their success, that lays the groundwork for making it through the high school years, doesn't it? But if your children grow up equating what you do is a reactive action, that they have to do something wrong before they get your attention. Do bad in school, then they get your attention. Do bad in sports, then they get your attention. Get a bad report at church, then they get your attention. Then they're indifferent towards you when they're in high school. We've been going our own ways, right? You go your way, Mom, Dad, I go mine. Isn't that how the house has been run? We don't eat sit-down meals together. You didn't help me with my schoolwork. I taught myself to read. Other strangers taught me to read. You didn't teach me mathematics. Strangers taught me mathematics. You didn't teach me the Bible. Strangers at church taught me the Bible. You didn't come home from work. I put myself to bed sometimes, or strangers put me to bed, or relatives I didn't know very well put me to bed. And we just go on our different ways, right, Mom and Dad? And now I'm in high school and I'm old enough to just verbalize what you have been doing non-verbally for the last 14 years. Isn't that right? But no, that's not how we raise our children. We get involved in their life. I'm 55 years old. By God's grace, I'll live another 15 or 20 years. That's a lifetime, isn't it? And I have freedom to be irresponsible now, don't I? I can come to Kenya and I can move into a little cabin that my friend owns, and I can just travel around and go to Nigeria and teach the Bible and do all these things. And all my children are established and settled and successful in life, and now I can do it. But I haven't lived my life this way. When my children were little, I stayed at home, and I came home, and I behaved myself. And we didn't live in the best house in the neighborhood, but your kids don't have to live in the best house in the neighborhood to do well in school, do they? They don't. They have to live in a safe neighborhood, but they don't have to live in the best neighborhood. They're too busy. Sometimes it's by their own personality bias. I had a good friend who was probably, Eleanor and I were talking because I was thinking about this lecture. I asked Eleanor, who's the most intelligent person you've ever met in your whole life? And she said this guy's name. He's probably only one of two true celestial geniuses that I've ever met. For instance, I was trying to memorize Romans 8, and I was getting him to review it, and when we finished the review cards, he had it memorized better than I did. Now, you know what Rubik's Cubes are? My kids used to play with them. You know what those are, don't you? I picked him up. He was a doctoral student in computer robotics at Rice University, one of the premier engineering schools in the U.S. And there was a Rubik's Cube. Of course, all of us had given up on it. And I was just picked him up on campus, and I was just driving him across campus to a hamburger place. And he was just talking with me, and, you know, pretty everything was white, red, black by the time we got there. He was hardly even looking at it. He was just talking. And this man was brilliant. But, you know, he wasn't interested in any of these things. What was he interested in? Zeros and ones. Wasn't he? Huh? He lived for zeros and ones. And even for an Mzungu, I mean, Errol, stand up. Now, you thought I was a white man, didn't you? Stand up. This is a sin. Now, this is a white man right here. Okay, you can sit down. He's a fan. He's Finns, he's Scandinavians. Now, they're white. But, you know, even for an American and Zungu, you know, who we've been intermarrying over there in America for 200 years, from being inside so much, he had that white kind of pasty skin. You would have thought he was sick because all his time was computers. And his children were brilliant too. But he asked me one time what I thought about it. And I said, I'll call him Larry. I'm picking on the name Larry now. Larry, if your children, if they live for zeros and ones like you do, computer programming, then it won't be any problem. But you know, what if your children don't live for zeros and ones? What if one of them has an appreciation of music? What if one of them likes auto mechanics or art or pottery? What if one of them really likes football or basketball or ping pong or badminton or cricket or croquet? What if they like that? When they get into high school, they are going to resent you because you didn't develop them to be well-rounded. Not everybody thinks that the best way to spend a Saturday afternoon is with spreadsheets and computers and graphs in the room dark and quiet, and all you can hear is this. You know, not everybody views that as heaven. So he was willing to think about it, but he wasn't willing to act on it. Too impatient or demanding. Some parents are such perfectionists in the area of music, their children would just rather not learn to play the violin than to hear the constant harping and criticism of their parents. That's a shame, isn't it? They would just rather not learn to play the piano. They would just rather not learn how to do pottery or auto mechanics. They would just rather not learn how to play basketball than have their father bullying them on the basketball court. Isn't that true? An unwillingness to go with the child's personal bent. My son, really, and I both like athletics. His favorite two sports are fishing and baseball. I grew up with very little interest in either one. But rather than forcing him to do what I like to do, I went with his bent and helped him be successful in those things which he liked. Now, he also had to take piano. All of our children had to take piano. He didn't like piano. He wasn't gifted at piano, but it's just a good skill to have. But we didn't make him become a pianist, right? He also had to take art, and he also had to be involved in a school musical. But we didn't make him be an artist or a play-acting performer. What he loved was sports. So even though it was good for him to learn these other things, we went with his bent. We had another daughter who loved music. She played one instrument and taught herself piano. But she had to learn volleyball. She didn't have to become an athlete. She had to learn softball, not become an athlete, simply because in church and college youth groups, we knew those skills were important. So we went with their bent. We went with their bent. And the main way to do it, how do you do this? Two ways. One, you are their greatest fan. And two, if you don't know how to do it, find someone who does. Find someone who does know how to do it. The next area of blessing that you should be involved in with your children is their social life. But keep in mind, I rarely meet Christian parents who don't feel that they can beat this verse. They're going to beat it. It's 1 Corinthians 15:33. It says, bad company corrupts good morals. I rarely meet parents who don't think they're going to be the exception. Even though their cousins are little hellions, even though their employer's children are spoiled black brats, even though you can fill in the blank, they think, well, my children are going to be able to play with those children unaffected. Is that true?
No.
No. My first responsibility in the social life of my children is their success. It is not, my first responsibility is not to my brother, my sister, my brother-in-law or my sister-in-law, my employer, the deacon, my friends at church. That's not my first responsibility. My first responsibility is to my children. And if Eleanor and I sat down and talked about it, and we realized that this, if we continue an active family social life, where our children were going to go and be in that home, if this was going to be at work, we just didn't do it. Sometimes people got upset, sometimes they didn't care, but you cannot beat this verse. It's God's word. Good in the area of social interaction of children, good will not overcome evil. Evil will always overcome good. Don't send your children back to spend the summer with pagan relatives involved in pagan rituals. Don't do it. We didn't. Both of us had relatives who were non-Christians with a non-Christian lifestyle, and they didn't get to host our children. They didn't do it. Did that make them happy? Well, no, it didn't. They were very upset. And we prayed that they would repent and come to Christ and have a Christian home that our children could go spend extended time in. But apart from us, they didn't go into those environments. There were nieces and nephews that our children didn't grow up playing with because the nieces and nephews did not have Christian virtues. They did not have Christian manners. And they were not healthy children. And so that was just it. One of the main reasons why the parents fail, one of the main reasons parents fail, if they are mature Christians, is they use their children as evangelism outreach tool. And that's wrong. Our children are not evangelism outreach tools. They are our prized possession that we protect. The second reason parents fail is it's a lot of work to keep track of who your children are around. What is success in social life for a child? The success in social life is Hebrews 10, 24 and 25. Let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more, to have Christian friends that they interact with. You need to make that decision for them. Proverbs 18:24 conversely says, a man of many friends comes to ruin. It was never the goal for our children to have many friends. It was always the goal of our children to have a few friends of high character. And you may have a couple who's in Bible study with you, and he may be your best friend, but that doesn't mean his son should be your son's best friend. You may have an employer that you spend a lot of time with, and you may spend a lot of time with him, but that doesn't mean your daughter should spend time with his daughter. You may have a relative who has children, and the relative is always saying, oh yeah, have them come over and spend the weekend. Come over for a week. Well, you may take the children over there to visit that relative in your presence, but that doesn't mean the best thing for your child is to spend extended time in that home. This doesn't. And that includes parents. Or for the child, it would be grandparents. For the sake of family unity, you do not have to allow your parents to indoctrinate your children into pagan rituals and cult practices. You do not have to do that to honor your parents. And to the degree which my non-Christian parents and Eleanor's non-Christian parents were willing to respect our values as Christians and the values and to create that environment around our children, that was the degree to which they had the freedom of our children. Okay? So, Hey, my children are all walking with God. If you want to roll the dice on your children, you go right ahead. But 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, when you gamble with the social life of your children, you will always lose. So, do we believe the Bible or not? Okay, so how do we do this? Well, first thing we do is we have Christian values. So what don't we do? We don't use our children as evangelistic tools. We don't use our children as social tools to get ahead in life, right? What do we do? We know firsthand what's going on. One of the best pieces of advice I was given by an older Christian woman, because Eleanor and I were always asking people with well-behaved children, what's the key? One of the best pieces of advice we were given was, you be the parent who has the party. You be the parent who picks up and delivers. You be the parent who hosts the events. You be the involved parent, because that's the only way you will know who their friends are and what they're like. And not only that, you know what we found? A child whose parents were actively involved in their life. You know, the bad kids didn't want to be around that child. Why? Because they might be found out. Isn't that true? Even if the child didn't tell, you're a snoopy parent, aren't you? We were very snoopy parents. We'll get into this more in the teenage years, but even in the early elementary school years, we had two rules. Our children couldn't go into a home that we hadn't been into. That was the first thing. Our children couldn't stay for alone and play in a home or spend the night in a home that had an adult living in the home that wasn't a blood relative by marriage or birth. Does that make sense? In other words, there's not going to be any live-in boyfriends. Or there's an adult child there and his girlfriend or one of his boyfriends also lives there. No. 1 Corinthians 15:33. What are you going to say to your child when they tell you that the reason they have a drinking program is because grandpa gave them beer? Why did you leave me with grandpa? You know he drank beer. You knew he had a drinking problem. Why did you leave me with him? What are you going to say? What are you going to say to your daughter when she says her uncle molested her? You knew he was an alcoholic. You knew he was a pagan. You knew he went to those ritual events. And let me spend weekends in their house. And you knew he would be drinking. And that he would come into the room, you know, demon-possessed. What are you going to say to them? What are you going to say? You know, you knew Auntie would take me over to the village shaman and they would put that dust on me and those demons would terrorize me. What are you going to say? What's your response going to be? Well, I just didn't want to make anybody mad. You were supposed to protect me. God gave me to you. You were the Christian. Where were you? I didn't want to have that conversation with my children. So I didn't. Do you want to have that conversation with your children? Then don't. Okay? That's easy, isn't it? Last experience. And we close with this. I learned this from the Pentecostal minister who lived across the street from us. He had three boys who were all boys. That my son was best friends with them, and by their age, they were 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, by age. My son was right in the middle. And we called them the four bear cubs. Because you know how little boys are? No matter what they were playing, they all ended up wrestling and laughing or wrestling with each other, you know. They just look like little bear cubs, just tumbling around. They'd start out playing checkers, but they'd end up all tumbling and wrestling. They'd, you know, play football, but they'd all end up tumbling and wrestling. They were the four bear cubs. Well, he was a devout Pentecostal minister, and there are certain social things in America that devout Pentecostals do not do. They don't do mixed bathing, swimming. Does that make sense? In other words, the boys and girls all don't jump in water with each other half naked. You know, They don't do that. And so, but in America, public swimming pools are mixed, aren't they? So, how did he deal with this? He sacrificed greatly to have a swimming pool in his backyard. And then his boys could have all their friends over in a Christian environment that he would host for swimming. You see, Ecclesiastes, let's go to Ecclesiastes here. Let me find my verse here. Ecclesiastes 11, 9 and 10. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood. Follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that the Lord will bring you to judgment for all these things. In other words, God the Holy Spirit is saying, hey, in the realm of the judgment of God, just don't get involved in sin. For a young man, for a young woman, a broad base of experience is good, isn't it? Now, why do parents fail in this area? They fail in this area for one of two reasons. One reason is they don't keep an eye on the experiences their kids are having, and they end up sinning. Another reason they fail in this area is that just everything becomes no. Let's take Christian music. Everything is no. No, you can't do it. For a teenager, if everything is wrong, then they come up with their own value system. Let's take Christian music. Well, hard rock music, that's evil. That's of the devil. Well, even soft rock music, that's still too sensual. Well, okay, Christian music. Well, that hard rock music, that the beat, that's evil, that's sensual too. You can't. Well, how about more gentle rock? Well, you know, the lady who's singing it, she got a divorce, and all those Christian rock singers, they're all bad. You got, well, what about hymns? Well, there's not good doctrine in those hymns. I don't like those hymns. Okay, well, the pastor wrote his own song. Oh, yeah, but the pastor doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, well, pretty soon, I mean, everything can't be wrong, right?
Yeah.
And in the relationship with your child, in the area of experience, if everything is wrong, if Pastor Horner had said, you know, mixed bathing is wrong, but even just swimming itself is wrong, and, you know, even swimming with boys is wrong, and, you know, we won't even have a swimming, you're not even going to learn how to swim. If you're in a culture where swimming is esteemed as a teenager, you're going to begin thinking, you know, I have to come up with my own value system. So we don't make that mistake, do we? You know, one of the reasons they fail is it's easier just to say no. Right? What is our objective in experience? Our objective in experience is our child's success, isn't it? So we are trying to think, what are those life experiences that when our child goes to apply for a job or goes to apply for college or gets into high school, what are those life experiences which will give them confidence and a competitive edge in the world? In America, we have something called a resume. And when you apply for college, they want to know your grade points, and they also want to know what clubs and academic societies are. But there's always a section for life experience. You know, show us that you have done things in life that reveal to us that you are ambitious, and if we give you all this free money to go to college, it will be well spent. And that's what we were thinking about for our children. So one of the ways you do this is that rather than just saying no, you substitute a valid Christian activity. One of our daughters was graduating from the fifth grade at near the top of the class. Well, the students were all going to get to go to a movie as a reward. Well, the movie they were choosing was one that we just could not be happy with. So what's the alternative? The alternative is the child can, instead of getting on the bus with the other students, the child can spend the day in the library reading. So what we did was we checked her out of school that day, and mommy took her in to another city. They went out and had kind of a brunch together, went shopping in a very nice mall, saw a very appropriate movie, got back late, stopped and had dinner at a very nice restaurant, and then came home. So when she went back to school the next day, she had a Christian experience which was competitive with everybody else's. That's what you need to do this for your children. What did Pastor Warner do? He didn't just say no to his son. He gave him a Christian experience that was competitive, didn't he? All the high school students for spring break are going down to the beach. There's going to be drinking. There's going to be sex. There's going to be carousing. Did we let our children over spring break go down to the beach? No. But they also didn't just have to sit in their room. We researched Christian camps. We gave them opportunities to take mission trips. We took them ourselves up to places, like in the mountains, camping or something like that. When they came back to school, they had Christian experiences that were equal and just as good to what the non-Christians had, only they were Christian. And it helped them get scholarships. And a good church is a real help in this. A church that has youth camps and takes mission trips, that has a youth praise band, has a youth drama team, has youth and children's puppet ministry, that has a lot of life experiences. Because when all of our children applied for college, they had speaking ability, music ability, public performance, trips out of town. They had done a lot of service activities for poor people and indigent people. They had teaching experience, public speaking experience, and we can thank our church for that. That was our church youth program. And all they had to do is reword that on their resume. Just reword it a little bit. You know, one Saturday a month volunteered in Clothes Closet for poor in downtown Houston. Wow, that's a serious child. You know, spoke on AIDS awareness at the high school because our children were Christians, and so they gave the Christian perspective on abstinence. Wow, you know, sang in worship team before hundreds of people regularly. Wow, you know, this is a person with confidence. This person has had a lot of life experiences. We ought to hire this person. We ought to give this person a scholarship. What does it all come back to, though? What's the objective? Remember? We are thinking about what? That's what and we've got to think, don't we? We're all going to Mombasa after church today, so let's all go north. Right? You can't get there by going north, can you? You've got to think, don't you? You have to find out what bus goes there, where is the road, how do we do it? We have to think about this. Right? We have to think. And your children, you don't have to have a PhD and be making the best job, and your ma and mom have a PhD to pull this off, do you? You can get the PhD after the last child leaves for college, can't you? You can do this where you are today. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you for the privilege of this time together, and we pray that you would give us focused attention to our children, that we would draw near to them by making them a success. It would not be you doing it because of our negligence, but we would have riches in heaven, and our children would share in those riches because of our faithfulness to your holy word. In Christ's name we pray, amen.